Hey, folks, I'm Sam Cedar, and I have an announcement to make. No, I'm not retiring. Sorry. And no, Donald Trump has not had a stroke. Again, apologies. No, it's good news, which is not to say that some of those other things I just mentioned might not be good news, but this is a different type of news. We're launching a new podcast. Now, I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, Sam, what's wrong with you? The Majority Report puts out more content every week than I can listen to now. Are you insane? Well, the answer is, you may be right. I may be crazy, but it just might be a lunatic you're looking for. Forget that. Sorry. The point is, the new show is going to be short. It's going to be a morning show that basically gives you the top stories to watch out for throughout the day. It'll be quick, super quick, like a quickie. In fact, we're calling it Majority.fm's AM Quickie. Now I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, Sam, are you insane? How are you going to do two shows every day? Who's going to feed your kids breakfast when you have custody of them? How are you going to prep for the Majority Report? Well, the answer is Lucy. In fact, Lucy Steiner. Lucy, are you here?
Hi, Sam.
Hi, Lucy. Lucy Steiner, ladies and gentlemen. Lucy is a comedian who worked with our very own Brendan on a political comedy show that sadly never launched. She's funny and smart, and I know you're going to love hearing from her when I'm tied up with the kids in the morning.
Ah, thanks, Sam. We're launching the show Wednesday of this week. It'll be live in the Majority Report feed for the first few weeks, so you won't need to do anything extra to find it. Eventually, we're hoping to have it posted in the morning every day by 8:30 a.m., but that might take a while.
That's right, folks. You know the routine. We'll drop something in the feed tomorrow morning to get you ready for Majority.fm's AM Quickie. Thanks, Lucy.
Thank you, Sam.
And now for the Majority Report.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Tuesday, July 9th, 2019. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal, the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Sarah Reckow, co-author of Outside Money in School Board Elections, the Nationalization of Education Politics. Also on the program today, Epstein could implicate Trump officials and naturally Dems in full retreat. Meanwhile, Bill Barr says Donald Trump can add a citizenship question to the census if he wants to. Felix Sater, supposedly set to testify behind closed doors to the intelligence community today. And Tom Steyer decides to waste $100 million. Meanwhile, another billionaire candidate, Ross Perot, dies. Democrats set to subpoena Kushner and Sessions and more, and then probably do nothing. The Fifth Circuit to hear a case which could end the ACA. Democrats literally walking away from the offer to see Donald Trump's tax returns. And a federal judge quashes the rule requiring drug prices on TV. Meanwhile, the hotly contested surrogate, if you will, Dem fight in the Queens DA race heads to what will be a laborious hand recount. And Pennsylvania goes after reformer prosecutor Larry Krasner's powers. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Just an incredibly frustrating day already. I'm already super irritated. I don't know if that's coming across a little bit. We got to turn the fan down in here. It's a little bit loud. But that's also it's running in parallel with the grinding noise that is in the back of my brain right now when I see the just utter, there, you know, over the past 6 months, I think one could at various times make reasonable arguments that the Democrats have a strategy that favors the 2020 elections over a lot of things that they should be doing. I thought my feeling would be that that would be at least a somewhat rational argument to make. I think it's not a particularly strong one, but it's becoming apparent that there is, to the extent that there is any strategy here, it seems to be basically, let's just go away and hope that Donald Trump and Republicans are bad enough that people vote against them. Like, let's not even forget offering some type of other vision. They're, in some respects, they're doing that. The Democrats have passed 55 pieces of legislation. They're going to pass a $15 an hour minimum wage. Every single piece of this, these pieces of these legislation die before they get to the threshold of the Senate, because Mitch McConnell knows there's no reason for him to even hold a vote on these things. In fact, it would be stupid for him to hold a vote on these things. Why go on the record as being against them? 2 or 3 weeks ago, Sherry Bustos, the head of the DCCC, presumably one of the key architects of this strategy, was bemoaning the fact that voters don't seem to be paying attention to anything they're doing. And of course, when you make that assessment, right, what they say is like, you know, awareness of the problem is 50% of the solution. Apparently, it's about 5% of the solution. Because the Democrats seem to be, and by the Democrats, I'm talking about the leadership of the Democratic Party in the form of Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi. And maybe it's more Chuck Schumer's fault. It's hard to make that argument when you see that not only are they not pursuing impeachment, they are not pursuing the low-hanging fruit of just basic oversight. They're not even pursuing rhetorical oversight. Yesterday, Andrew Cuomo signed a bill that allowed for the Ways and Means Committee, as dictated by the chairman of that committee, to see the taxes of any individual it wants in New York State. In other words, if you want to see Donald Trump's state taxes, you can see them. You won't have the federal taxes, but it's going to give you a very good notion of what's in there, broadly speaking. And Richard Neal's response was, no, thank you. He waited months to file a lawsuit to get them out of a federal court after Mnuchin said no. Waited months to ask, and then waited to file the lawsuit. And then when given the, basically given the taxes, he says, I know it's in that envelope, not going to open it. When the Miami Herald does a story that implicates Alex Acosta and then is subsequently found to have basically broken the law, Alex Acosta, as a U.S. attorney, in the way that he made a sweetheart plea deal for a guy who's running basically a child prostitution ring. One would think that as the sitting Secretary of Labor, the Democrats might say, hey, that's a bad guy. You're a bad guy for letting a pedophile just seemingly walk away and also letting off his co-conspirators who apparently had to serve no time. Remember, he served time in a county jail. I imagine if you're a billionaire, you can make county jail pretty cush. And I think he got to go out 6 days a week.
Yeah, he's able to work every day.
And I imagine that must have been some hard work he was doing at his home office. And when asked yesterday, do you have any comments regarding Alex Acosta of Democrats, including Chuck Schumer, who is the leader of the Senate, who opposed Acosta? Now that Jeffrey Epstein has been indicted by the feds in New York, are you going to say anything about it? No. That might draw attention to him in some fashion. Here's the question. When Bill Barr tells Donald Trump, you can go and put and change this question on the census, even after the Supreme Court has said you cannot. And if Donald Trump does it, what are the Democrats going to do? How do you let this stand? How do you let, like, what is left? This is a real problem because they seem to be hell-bent. I mean, there's one thing with like, okay, the circumstances 6 months ago, it looks like we shouldn't impeach. We shouldn't impeach. The Mueller report comes out. It doesn't, Bill Barr did a great job of spinning this thing beforehand. We shouldn't impeach. Oh, they're completely obstructing every single reasonable ask for us to fulfill our oversight function. We shouldn't impeach. Oh, the Secretary of Labor was involved in some type of large cover-up that could very well implicate the president. Incidentally, we may take some time to go into this, but y'all remember, there was a woman who filed a lawsuit against Donald Trump in California, claiming that she was sexually assaulted by him in Epstein's house. She refiled in New York in the run-up to the election and then was supposedly intimidated away. But she names people who apparently are also named in the Epstein scandal. Now, maybe she did some research and she's absolutely crazy and decided to do this. I suppose stranger things have happened. But Occam's razor would suggest that maybe actually there's a problem here. Maybe there were co-conspirators involved. And where are the Democrats on this? It's not even a question of being on the sidelines. They're leaving the stadium. They're leaving the state. They seem to want to go into a different time zone. Completely backing into this stuff. Looking at what they're doing, seeing it's not working, and then doing absolutely nothing about it. Absolutely nothing. Like, at what threshold? I mean, it really is honestly as if they've dug in so much now that there is nothing that this administration could do that would cause them to exercise oversight in a meaningful way. They have apparently this concept of oversight overreach. What it's based upon, I have no idea. Because we had, was it 7 different investigations into Benghazi? Maybe it's more. I don't know. Millions upon millions of dollars. When was the last time a Republican said the words Benghazi? The only thing that came out of Benghazi, of all of it, there were 10 different unique investigations into what happened in Benghazi. Can anybody remember what the inciting incident was in this? It was, there was an attack on what turned out to be, well, was theoretically the embassy annex in Benghazi. The first assessment of this attack was that it was a part of a protest that was going on in the Arab world to a video that had been released about Mohammed. This was going on in about, if I recall, on that day, in 7 or 8 different locations, some places where these places were overrun, where embassies were, people broke through some of the compounds. I remember this distinctly because I think I was hosting Chris Hayes' weekend program that, and I remember the graphic of the different like little dots on there and when this was when was happening. And because the State Department thought it was part of the video, they didn't send people in. I think it's also quite possible that it was CIA affiliated, that there may have been a weapons cache there. Cache. And so they weren't, so the government wasn't, the U.S. government wasn't fully transparent about what was, why that place may have been attacked. Regardless, 10 different investigations, one material thing came out of these investigations. One material thing. That Hillary Clinton had a private email server, which, as you know, ended up implicating the 2016 election, depending on who you talk to, significantly or quite significantly. That is what the Comey letter was all about. So, and recall, if you can find a single person who said they voted against Republicans in 2016 or 2018 because of the Benghazi overreach, I would like to meet that person. If you could find anybody, the most partisan Democrat, who will list the Benghazi oversight overreach as the top 5 reasons why they don't like Republicans today, without any prompting, I will send you, I don't know, a sticker or I don't know. What do we got over there? I see some bolts. I don't know.
Got lots of books.
Send him
we'll
a book.
Send you a book.
We'll sign it.
There you go.
But don't rig it. The point being that what the Democrats are doing are it's completely without any foundation in the real world. And it is a total failure of leadership. It's not even a skittish leadership. It's not even a terribly lacking in imagination strategy. It's just complete and utter abdication of any role in our government. It is both political malfeasance and just governmental malfeasance. Like, you need to serve your role as oversight. It just so happens that there's probably a huge boon politically involved in that. But nothing. I mean, it's stunning.
Well, that was very inspiring. Can I ask you a question, however, Sam? Do we have a moment, or do you need to riff more?
Well, go ahead.
Are you going to continue to tell me how to do my job? Have you talked to anybody recently about their experience with Invisalign treatments?
I have not.
You have not, have you? Well, I could tell you that there are a lot of good, common sense, middle class Americans who aren't obsessed with partisan warfare or child sex trafficking or whatever goes on in your head, who are quite upset that they think they're going to have a hassle-free path to a perfect smile, and they are not getting that return. That's the kind of common sense, everyday American thing that we're going to continue to work on in the Senate. And if you don't like that and you're leftist, partisan, extremist broadcast, then there's nothing I can do to help you. Oh, I'm sorry. My wife's on the other line. Apparently, there's a parking space by the Brooklyn Public Library she doesn't like.
I'm going to, honestly, and then I'm not even talking about Tom Steyer yet.
It's too much to take on at once.
No kidding. All I can think of is, I just want to take a hammer over there and just pound it on my hand till this feeling goes away.
Disgusting that he can. There's literally millions of places the guy could put his money more effectively.
Tom Steyer? Oh, yeah, yeah. No. I mean, we'll get into that later. Folks, let me just try and regain my composure here by telling you about Capterra. This is what I would call a Capterra moment for me. This is when I start to scroll through their huge assortment of reviews on different business software and contemplate what other business could I go into that will not make me this angry. As you know, whether you're trying to get a sweet deal on something or you're looking for a restaurant, whatever it is, you go to a review site, right? Well, why should be looking for the right software for your business be any different? You can read thousands of real software reviews and find the right software for your business at capterra.com/majority. This is an amazingly simple idea. It just assembles all of the software that exist for, I don't know, 700 specific categories of business software, and then gives reviews for them. So there's 700, I don't know how many different ones are in each one, but I mean thousands of pieces of software that are reviewed, 850,000 reviews of products from real software users, from project management to email marketing, has everything you need to make an informed decision fast. Millions of people use Capterra each month to find the right tools for their business. Bakery software. Maybe I could go and own a bakery.
That would make you more calm.
More calm. God damn it. Where are the croissants?
That's good self-insight right there.
There you go. Exactly. Claims processing software. Class registration software. Clinical trial management software. I'm just in the C's. Let me scroll down to the F's. Financial reporting software, financial risk software, fire department software, fitness software, fleet maintenance software, food service distribution, forestry software. I think that would be actually good for me. Go and work in some type of forestry service. Gamification software. Gamification software. Maybe we could do that with government software, GPS tracking software, gradebook software. Scroll all the way down here to W's warehouse management, website builder, wireless expense management software, workforce management, worship software. You can go there and just basically looking for a new job. Just go there and decide by looking at all the different software. You can visit capterra.com/majority for free today to find the tools that make an informed software decision for your business. capterra.com/majority. That's Capterra, CAPTERRA.com/majority. Capterra, software selection totally simplified. All right, we didn't even get to that story of this guy. Do we have time for it? No. Okay. We're going to go take a quick break and talk to Sarah Reckow on how money is influencing school board elections.
Oh, that's fascinating. This is Tom Steyer.
Yeah. Nationalizing education politics. Honestly, we'll be right back. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Associate Professor in the Department of Political Science at Michigan State University, awarded a fellowship from the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study in 2018-2019, and co-author with Jeffrey Hennig and Rebecca Jacobson of Outside Money and School Board Elections, The Nationalization of Education Politics. Sarah Reckow, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much for having me.
So just you looked at five cities, is that right, to do this study?
Yes, that's right.
Okay, tell us the five cities.
The five cities are Denver, Los Angeles, New Orleans, Indianapolis, and Bridgeport, Connecticut.
And why those cities?
So we were interested in understanding something we'd been reading about in the news a bit, that there were big donors that lived out of state who were giving money to school board candidates, which seemed unusual, given what we know about school board elections being kind of low-profile, back-burner events, not a big presidential or congressional election. And so we wanted to understand it deeply, to look at the full scope of campaign contributions in these elections, look at the candidates. So we picked five cities where we knew there had been some news coverage of this phenomenon. This is out of a potential set of cases of about 43, mostly larger localities where we were able to identify media coverage on this type of activity. But then we went really deep to get a picture of what was going on.
And when did you start this project, and what were the years in which you were looking at the data sets, I guess?
Sure. So the data that we gathered covers election cycles from 2008 to 2014 across the five cities. And that includes all the campaign contributions we could possibly get our hands on, everything that was reported in campaign finance reports. And so this doesn't just include money that goes to candidates, but includes money to independent expenditure committees and PACs. What you know has gone on more recently, where 501c4s have become a bigger factor in some campaigns, was not as much of an issue during the time period we were looking at. That tends to be less transparent money. But we gathered union contributions, various types of reform organizations, money from individuals, and then we all total we had more than 18,000 campaign contributions in our data set from that time period.
And when did you start this? When did this research start and end? Not when it covered, but when did you actually, when did the three of you actually?
Oh, when did we conduct the research?
Exactly.
So the book just came out this spring, and we conducted most of the research roughly in the, would be about 2016, 2017 time frame. But prior to that, we started collecting the data earlier, and then we were interviewing candidates. We wrote up an article, and then we wrote the book. So our interviews were also a big part of that process, interviewing candidates in all five of the cities that were part of the study.
So when you start in 2008, in terms of what you're looking at, is the phenomena that you're finding here, has it begun? Is it, where is it in the course of its life, I guess?
Yeah. So in 2008, there was very little going on, and that was sort of helpful for us to get a sense of change. Indianapolis is a particularly striking case of this, where you look back at their 2000. The earliest election we have in our data for them, and it would be what I think people would think of as a typical school board election. Not a lot of money, most of it being contributed from local people who live in Indianapolis or surrounding communities. And then that changes quite a bit, especially by the time you get to 2012 in Indianapolis. Much higher sums, raised by candidates, much more expensive, and these donors who live outside of the state of Indiana who are contributing money. Really, the only city in our cases that you might say always had expensive school board elections was Los Angeles. And that's not that surprising. Los Angeles is the second largest school district in the country. The school board districts that candidates run in are larger than congressional districts. It's a huge and expensive media market. So it's a different kind of beast compared to the other four, where you can really see a change that kind of comes after about 2010 or 2011 when the money starts to grow quite a bit.
Okay. And I want to talk about that comparison between the sort of the smaller towns in LA in terms of this context, but in a bit. So tell us, like, who are, when this new money is coming in during really over the course of the first term of the Obama administration, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Because presumably this money doesn't just show up. Somebody decides like, oh, I'm going to contribute to, some random school board races this cycle. There has to be sort of, there's ideas, there's organizations, right? There's, we start to generate targets. So who are the donors that are giving this money that are developing through this time? And how much do you know about their process in assessing who they're going to contribute to?
Right. So, and one interesting example, just to feature one individual, is John Arnold. He is based in Houston. He's a billionaire. He made his money in energy investing, started out at Enron, started a hedge fund focused on energy. In our data set, we have a total of $63,400 in school board contributions from John Arnold that went to candidates and committees in school board elections in Denver, Los Angeles, and New Orleans. And of course, he lives in Texas, right? So he doesn't live in any of the states or cities in our study. So what else do we know about John Arnold? Well, John Arnold, along with his wife, Laura Arnold, they've started a philanthropy. Part of their philanthropic work has focused on education. And so he has, in addition to his finance career, has been involved as an education philanthropist. And so what we did, once we identified a group of people like John Arnold, the way we defined them was people who had given at least $1,000 in a single election cycle, which may not sound like a lot, but in school board elections, that actually is quite a bit.
Can I just stop you there? Give us a sense of how much that is. I mean, relatively speaking, because when I hear you tell me a billionaire gave $63,000, that's literally like me going out and I'm going to buy a sandwich today. I'm going to, instead of just my hard boiled egg for lunch, I'm going to buy a full on sandwich. Maybe even less, actually. But to the recipient, in a typical race, I guess, for the school board in all these places, how much money is generally spent?
Right. So there's been some studies of this. One from based on elections from 2010, you have a study showing that less than 3% of candidates for school board report spending more than $25,000. So we're talking about elections where your total fundraising take could be thousands of dollars or tens of thousands of dollars. But certainly not hundreds of thousands of dollars. And so what we get with these large donors is that even though to them, absolutely, as a billionaire, this is not a huge amount of money at all, right? but for the campaigns that they're giving to, so for instance, the 132 people we identify as these large out-of-state national donors, there are 132 of them. Out of more than 8,000 individual donors in our data set, and those 132 people gave 18% of the funds that went to the candidates who were basically We also looked at the candidates' positions. They were overwhelmingly aligned with like educational reform, sort of pro-charter school and the like in local elections. They also gave 51% of the funds that went to reform-aligned PAC and independent expenditure committee. So where their influence is really outsized is in these independent expenditure committee type groups. I think what partly explains that is the fact that candidates tend to be more subject to campaign finance limitations in the local elections, whereas these other groups can raise unlimited funds. So you can write a really large check.
I see. So it's all relative when we're talking about from the candidate's perspective, because because they're capped anyways. So if you get somebody to give you $1,000 in a race in in Bridgeport, Connecticut to be on the school board, you've done 10% of your fundraising essentially. Right? I mean, that's basically what it comes down to.
Yeah, I mean, you raise, you know, it's important to add something from the candidate's perspective here that we learned, you know, from the interviews and some of the kind of more case study work is that in large part, they're not directly seeking these contributions. They don't know these billionaires. So instead, what's going on is there's more of an intermediary role with some groups that we haven't talked about yet, like
right.
Democrats for Education Reform, Stand for Children, that put kind of on the radar of people like John Arnold the fact that there's an interesting school board race in Denver, and these are some candidates aligned with the kinds of policy positions that these wealthy folks would probably support. So the candidates themselves are kind of, I mean, we had some funny quotes from candidates where they kind of said, wow, I didn't know that, you know, Reed Hastings, who's like CEO of Netflix is going to write me a check. That was interesting. And they have, you know, there's no personal contact really to speak of between the billionaire donors and the local candidates.
So really what we're talking about is you have billionaires sitting from a distance with these intermediaries, these organizations that are looking to push corporate reform in education, including charters. And we'll talk a little bit more about the implications of this. Basically saying, give us some fertilizer. We know which candidates we're just going to provide them with fertilizer. And their opponents will not have that fertilizer. And that's what will tip the scales here. This isn't a question where you have to go in and buy a candidate. The candidates already exist. We have isolated which ones are in favor of corporate reform, of all that agenda, and which ones are not, and we're just going to put our thumbs on the scale is basically what the calculation is.
Yeah, so the intermediary groups are the ones who play more of the role in identifying the candidates. It's important to point out, though, some of the other money that's part of this in a couple of ways. I mean, first of all, we do show that in these five cities, the candidates whose positions align more with education reform, with charter schools or teacher evaluation and things of that nature. Basically, we looked at positions that kind of aligned with the Race to the Top program of the Obama administration as our index for reform policies. And they raised more money. But they also raised more money locally. So there was kind of an interesting thing going on here of not just the outside national money really raising how much spending was going on in these elections, but it also activated local donors. Some of those donors also being kind of the more elite or business aligned groups within those specific cities. And then we also have teacher union money in these cities, which varies a great deal. So in Los Angeles, there's quite a bit more teacher union money, but in other places like New Orleans, where, you know, we have a whole long story post-Katrina there, and a very weak situation for teachers unions, so not very much union money there. So we look at the variation in that and the relative level of spending of each of these groups across the cities.
I want to ask, you know, to what extent that money ended up translating into victories, I guess. But before I do, in terms of that dynamic between the local and national money, were you able to determine how much of that local money was motivated by the national money insofar as if I am with the local, you know, I'm a local guy, and but I have a similar mentality to the corporate reformers. I don't like unions. I think there should be more private schools. I think we, you know, too much money for public education. I'm pissed about my tax dollars going into my property tax, whatever it is. That can motivate me to contribute. But also seeing that a candidate that I may support has already raised X number of dollars or is able to throw a fundraiser that they couldn't have but for the national dollars that come in, that may enhance my willingness to give. Was there any way to sort of measure that dynamic? Like how?
Yeah. I mean, you're asking a great question. It's one of these things, you know, coming from the perspective of a social scientist, you wish you could disentangle all the possible causal factors here. I mean, because we observe a lot of things going on that could possibly explain this. So one thing we find is that these candidates tend to get more, the candidates raising the outside money are also having more professionalized campaigns. So they're able to hire consultants they might not otherwise or fundraising professionals. So absolutely you would expect that could go along with a more effective local fundraising operation. You're also looking at competition, right? So my potential opponent is raising money, I raise more money, the opponent raises more, right? These things interact with one another in a competitive election. And there's just the basic issue of how low profile school board elections traditionally have been, and in many cases were in the very cities we look at. I'd say with the big, you know, with LA being more exceptional, but in Indianapolis or Bridgeport, you're talking about elections where we couldn't even find news coverage on some of the electoral cycles at the early part of our time frame. I mean, that's how low profile these were. Very low voter turnout. I mean, kind of pathetic from the standpoint of what you would like to see in, you know, a more vibrant local democracy. And so simply making the fact that people are aware there's a school board election going on, the names of the candidates, things of that nature, right? Money does help fuel that process of attention on an election. And so that would also go with that outcome.
Were you able to determine beyond the sheer dollars that were raised by these donors, like could you assess how many more people got elected, like what outcome it actually had on the elections?
So we looked at the outcomes. So the reform-backed candidates in our cities won 2.5 times more often than they lost. So they had a pretty high rate of success. The union-backed candidates were 50-50. And alongside that, though, is the fact that you had more money going to reform-backed candidates. So kind of more, there was lower efficiency for the reform dollars, if that makes sense, right? There was more reform money that wound up being spent on candidates who actually lost their elections, and unions were somewhat more efficient in how they distributed their money, even though they have a lower kind of success rate of the candidates.
That doesn't really tell you that much,
no.
other than, I mean, it's quite that there was enough money that we can bet on, you know, a candidate that has only 30% chance of odds of winning, as opposed to just reserve all our money for candidates that have a 60% chance of winning.
Aha. Yeah. And I mean, there's all kinds of questions to ask here about strategy. And I mean, unions tend to have more of the kind of local knowledge on the ground about candidates.
So in other words, two and a half times, to have two and a half times of a cohort win their elections as a function of that they're receiving a specific type of money, that's a significant.
Oh, yeah, it's huge. Absolutely. And I mean, we've seen, you know, we've seen sort of the school boards in a couple of these cities, Los Angeles and Denver being the most prominent, kind of become more solidly with a slate of candidates who, at least in the eyes of the people who endorse them, would have been considered pro-reform. I would we can talk more about this, but part of our findings in our book and from interviewing the candidates is that there's a little bit of a difference between the way the national groups try to label everyone as pro-reform or pro-union or what have you, and then the way the candidates at the local level describe their positions, which can be more nuanced. And so I think some of the polarization in these elections is actually coming from this national pressure. And to say that the school board suddenly flipped to pro-reform or something, I don't think is an accurate statement of what kind of policymaking is actually going on in these boards. But
so, okay, well, let's talk about what these pro-reform, so-called reform outfits were looking to get. Mm-hmm. When they, you know, obviously it's not just we want the people. I mean, I don't want to get too sort of like cynical or granular about this, but I'm sure some of these organizations, all they're concerned about was they win the elections and they can go back and get more money from these billionaires. But putting that aside, there is obviously an agenda that they have. We want more charters. We want vouchers. We want, you know, you can tell me what their agenda items were, and then to see how much of an actual impact it had in changing policy on the ground.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So charter schools are probably the most key issue that we see across the districts. And particularly, so if you look at Los Angeles and Denver, there's been, you know, a long ongoing expansion of charter schools in those cities. But in, especially, like, why focus on a local school board election? These are also cities where the local school board plays the most powerful role in authorizing charter schools, right? So the locus of decision making is with the local school board. So why this might not happen in other places is in other states, Michigan being one of them, you have other entities authorizing charter schools, and so it wouldn't make sense to put all your eggs into the basket of a local school board election, because that's not really where the decision making happens.
In Michigan, it's the state essentially that provides the
universities are actually the largest authorizers.
Oh, interesting.
In Michigan.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a whole other conversation, but. So that's part of what's happening here is you see this happening in some of the places where the local school board plays that really important role in charter school authorization. And then you have.
And can I just, I'm sorry, I just,
oh, yeah.
I presume that you could write another book about what's happening on the state level. I mean, in those states where that these same entities that are, sort of providing the conduit to this money and to the right candidates there are probably also have a plan for places like Michigan or Massachusetts or wherever it is, right? I mean,
yeah, you can talk to me in a few months. I'm working with a colleague, Leslie Finger, on a paper on state elections.
Okay. So. All right. I mean, just so that people understand that this is a big project. So give us a sense of in these school boards, like, did they got it, they got their money's worth, it seems, or at least, you know, I don't know if a billionaire really says, like, oh, I wasted $30,000. Maybe they do. I don't know. But they, to the extent that they got 2.5 times more candidates elected, than those who didn't receive the funding, Did they get similar types of results in terms of policy? And what did that look like?
So this is where I think the story gets complicated, or where I would say you've got to look at the specific cases to kind of see it play out. So I'll give a few examples. So one example is Bridgeport, which we haven't really talked about, as a small city in our study. First of all, Bridgeport was less a story about charter schools and more an issue about mayoral control of the schools. So our kind of reform coalition there was trying to get mayoral control of the schools, and there was a ballot initiative on this. In that case, the reform side lost. And what you had there was basically the high spending in elections really dropped off. It kind of fizzled away. Okay, so there's one example. Another example is New Orleans, where you've had a fair amount of money come in, especially the 2012 election, and Sarah Newell Usden, who is very involved in reform there and starting, you know, New Schools for New Orleans organization. And in that case, where especially with a weak union situation, they kind of spent a lot of money in 2012 and have kind of been able to just hold on to that coalition without having to kind of compete a lot. So in a place where your money is the main money, that can, you know, kind of sustain itself. And then I want to focus on Los Angeles, which is just, I think, a lot murkier when you look at the long-term story there. So what's gone on in Los Angeles, if you go back to, say, 2009, was a situation where the school board was seen as not entirely sort of pro-charter or pro-reform. And there were a series of candidates who raised money, especially to run against Steve Zimmer, who was a member of the school board, who was not seen as being as pro-charter. And so they had people who were considered pro-charter who were supposed to try to defeat him but lost. But during that time period, the Los Angeles School Board was continuously authorizing charter schools. And if you look year after year after year, the number of charter schools in LA Unified is growing, right? Even in the context of a school board that maybe Eli Broad would not have, one of the billionaires, one of the people who's giving a lot of money, would have not considered it to be a pro-reform board. But they're authorizing charter schools, right? This agenda is moving along. So then what happens is in 2017, you have the most expensive school board election ever in Los Angeles, and a board is elected that is viewed to be, okay, now we have a pro-reform majority on this board. Here we go. Elected, Steve Zimmer loses, here we are. Well, then what happens, this, you know, just a few months ago, Los Angeles teachers went on strike, and shortly after the strike, partly as a condition in resolving the strike, the school board actually, it was a symbolic vote, but votes on a charter school moratorium. And this theoretically pro-charter reform board passed this symbolic charter school moratorium. So in that regard, it's not clear to me that saying a board is or isn't pro, you know, a majority reform is not really is not really getting you enough information about what's going on in local politics, both in the sense that unions have other sources of power besides, you know, money and elections, and that a lot of these reforms, like authorizing charter schools, can proceed even when there are people on the board who are not as right. fully embracing charter schools as maybe the billionaire donors, you know, are trying to, you know, the kinds of people they are tending to support in these elections.
So it's I guess the bottom line is that to the extent that you can influence the outcome of this from the outside, they've been able to do that. But it's not necessarily a one-to-one relationship.
No, not at all. And I think, you know, it's both, on the one hand, it might be more influential in a situation where the local, you know, whether it's union or other local bases of power are just weaker. But on the other hand, it's a long game, right? Politics is a long game. It's not just won and lost in elections. And so to the degree we're talking about campaign money as one focus, yes, it can be a one potential factor in deciding who gets on the board, but the kinds of decisions those people end up making and the kinds of political calculus they have to have in response to a teacher strike or other, a budget crisis or other things that might emerge, they can make different kinds of decisions, right? And those donors are gone, right? They're not paying attention, so much anymore. So I think what we've tried to emphasize is the fact that local governing is definitely more than these elections.
And so, as we wrap it up, what is the lesson here? One of them clearly, and just so happens today, Tom Steyer decided to jump into the race as president, and he's committed supposedly $100 million of his own money. One of the things that seems pretty clear is that if Tom Steyer wanted to turn every single school board election in this country, he probably could on some level if he was willing to expend that money, among other races, I would imagine. But what ultimately happens here? It sort of feels like the national fight over education reform, in some ways, has either been resolved or is in route to being resolved. Like, you have the Gates Foundation, which I guess it was a year, maybe less than a year ago in December, basically announced through their RAND study that, hey, we made a mistake. We were wrong. We shouldn't have spent all that money. And you have folks like Arne Duncan now, and that's sort of that whole regime that brought race to the top, to the fore, seems largely discredited. The national teachers unions, anyways, seem to sort of be a lot more sensitive to getting in on the ground floor of these campaigns so that they can avoid another such debacle. What's your sense of that and sort of like the long-term sort of lessons that come out of what you found?
Sure. So to speak to kind of the interaction between the money we see in these elections and national politics, most of the large national donors that we looked at their federal giving, also the majority were Democrats, and so it does speak to that kind of what has, especially looking at the Obama administration era, a division within the Democratic Party about educational reform. And yes, that's clearly gone on the back burner during the Trump administration and with Betsy DeVos as Secretary of Education. I don't believe that it's gone away, right? So I don't believe that the same individuals have changed their position on charter schools, for instance. But they are staying quiet, right? They have definitely maybe have other priorities related to national politics that is causing them to keep their charter positions on the back burner for the time being. And we'll have to wait and see what happens amongst the Democratic presidential candidates and these varied factions in the Democratic Party going forward. As far as sort of billionaires and politics, absolutely, these kinds of local elections kind of are low-hanging fruit because they're such low-dollar elections traditionally. And so, to the degree interested individuals were to think, I could spend a lot of money and become, your money goes a lot farther in these races than it would in a congressional election or certainly than a presidential election. And so that's kind of an interesting dynamic here and something we were really able to observe going on in these races is how much, money from a very small number of people became a very large proportion of the resources being spent. And then finally, I think another take-home message is just, so So on the one hand, there's that, right? There's sort of the potential low-hanging fruit for very wealthy people if they were to think local elections were where they wanted to have influence. On the flip side, though, for the sort of, you have someone who cares about local school politics and maybe is concerned about what outside money entails, is, you know, we could all do better to pay more attention to our local elections. So, you know, part of what makes this low-hanging fruit is the fact that these elections are low profile. There's so little media coverage. There's so little attention. There's such low voter turnout. And frankly, that's because people aren't paying attention to them.
Right.
And so we could all do a bit better by making it something that is a focus. Important decisions are being made by these school boards. But a lot of people are so focused on the national level that we lose track of these elections.
Sarah Reckow, the book is Outside Money in School Board Elections, The Nationalization of Education Politics. Look forward to that piece on the states. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
All right, folks. We're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half. Well, let's do this thing. Let's do that clip that we were going to play at the top of the show. We didn't get to because I get so annoyed. But I mean, just that. Speaking of annoyed, Tom Steyer, I mean, I don't know where he is on education. I can't imagine it's, well, I have no idea. But what this guy could do with $100 million, my God. But we'll talk more about that later. Meanwhile, Fox News wants you to know that just because Donald Trump is not trying to cut Social Security at the moment, that day will come, and that it's super important for them to continue to remind their viewers that that Social Security is going to go bankrupt, even though it's not, and that the 401k plans, the fact that they're a failed experiment, not that relevant. How do you deal with these realities? How do you basically try and make people feel comfortable with the notion that it may be difficult for them to retire? Offer solutions? Or there's maybe another way.
Well, retirement inching closer to becoming a thing of the past for a lot of Americans. In fact, a recent poll finds nearly one in four people don't expect to ever leave the workforce. This as the number of people working multiple jobs also spiking. So why are so many people financially unfit to call it quits? Well, it's up for debate. So let's ask Trend Micro CIO Donald Luskin. You know, these kind of polls are always around, right? The bank rate does some things and other folks, but it's always alarming. 32% of people say they retired before age 65, which might be unrealistic, but 23% said never. Is that worrisome for you, Donald?
It doesn't worry me personally. I guess I'm one of those people who plans never to retire. I mean, I got to tell you, what do people do when they retire? You know, how do you spend a day? I mean, is bowling that interesting? Is fishing that interesting? I mean, I happen to love my work. Why do I want to stop it? You know, it's not like it hurts. Why would I stop it? This is great. What a great country where we have the opportunity to keep working. What a miracle where our lives are long enough and we're healthy enough and mentally alert enough so that we don't have to retire like generations before us. This is a great blessing. You should embrace it.
What's amazing is they are literally showing B-roll alongside this guy of just about every job that you could have where it actually literally does hurt. Yeah. Right? Like, hey, I'm working construction. I got news for you. Your body gives out in construction. If you can make it to 65 after a lifetime of construction, then you are super, super lucky.
Especially if you have all your fingers.
Well, your fingers, but I mean, never mind workplace injuries.
Back,
it's just
knees. It's just brutal.
Waiting tables, working in factories.
Every single piece of B-roll were things that were absolutely physical. They should have gotten B-roll of people getting taken in a town car to a TV hit. People exactly. sitting on their ass at a hedge fund. People getting a massive check from the Koch brothers.
People
to write
yelling
some,
at their assistants.
People yelling at their assistants to type faster as they dictate an Ayn Rand masturbatory fantasy.
This is, I mean, honestly, though, this is the sort of the perfect example of the last refuge, right? Where they go, like, the question is, why are so many people worried about the, you know, or you know, why can't we manage to have a perfect retirement? And this guy responds with, why can't we have, why would we want it?
Yeah, let's think outside the box.
Yeah, exactly. Folks, you don't need it. You just don't need it. Look at me. I'm doing great. Why would you need to retire?
I'm on TV right now. Why would you want to not wait tables when you're 85? Think about it.
Oh, my gosh.
And incidentally,
you are lucky.
I've listed a couple of activities that are really fun and rewarding to people. Let me add a few others. Who wants to spend more time with their family?
Exactly.
Families are a burden. My ex-wife's a total bitch, as an example.
This is the Luskin's John Galt. This is a guy who does like these ads on Fox, and who is he is going to let you into the secret. Here, play a little bit of this.
Why is Ayn Rand's great novel Atlas Shrugged a bestseller today, more than half a century after it was written? It's because our real world today is just like the fictional future that Rand foresaw in Atlas Shrugged.
Oh, God.
It's a time of crisis and decay, but it's also a world of innovation and achievement. It's a world of heroes and villains, driven by very different philosophies. We wrote I Am John Galt to tell their stories. We look at the heroic innovators who are building our world and show that they're doing it just like the heroes of Ayn Rand's novels. They're using her philosophy of capitalism, reason, objective reality, and self-interest.
Mm.
Who is John Galt? Meet John Allison, the mild-mannered Southerner who created one of America's greatest banking empires. He did it with Ayn Rand's philosophy by getting every one of his tens of thousands of employees to read Atlas Shrugged and live by its code. In the great financial crisis of 2008, his bank was about the only one that didn't need a government bailout. But the government forced Allison to take TARP money anyway. After that, Allison walked away, just like John Galt did. There's so many other Rand heroes in our midst. There's Bill Gates, the genius who built the world's greatest
I love.
Allison,
by the way,
was also
the
former CEO and president of the Cato Institute. We should look into.
Can you
John
just?
Allison.
Can we? I love the individualistic focus of forcing all of your employees to read a cult book.
And guess
it's
what?
It's super individualistic.
You don't need to. We don't need to contribute to your 401k because you don't want to retire anyways, guys. What are you gonna do?
The world is very similar to the time of John Galt in the sense that there's, in addition to pillaging and destroying the country, CEOs still need to have some delusional Russian author with no writing capacity tell them that they're like Che Guevara or like operating a bank. They need to be flattered on top of everything else. That is the incredible thing about Ayn Rand. It's like the actual economics of it makes sense if you are an oligarch, but the heroism of it shows that all of them secretly want to think of themselves as swashbuckling revolutionary.
That's the whole
or not so secretly
reactionary
when you read it, which
notion,
is why it's so funny.
Right? I mean, that's the whole notion of like the IDW and the fair, free market Fonzie. I mean, all of it.
Free market Fonzie.
Folks, reminder, Capterra is the leading free, totally free online resource to help you find the best software solution for your business with over 850,000 reviews, products from real software users. More than 700 specific categories of software. It has everything you need to make an informed decision fast. Visit Capterra.com/majority today for free to make an informed software decision for your business today. That's Capterra, Capterra.com/majority. Capterra software selection simplified. Reminder, you can support this program by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. It's your support that makes this possible. We are launching tomorrow the AM Quickie. It will be in your Majority Report feed. You don't have to do anything other than listen to it. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Today is Tuesday. Tonight is Tuesday night. That means the Michael Brooks Show.
Indeed. Tonight, we are talking about Hong Kong. We are talking about how Standing Rock Movement turned into a push for local and state-owned banks. Then we have an activist who's joining us from the occupied Western Sahara, which Morocco's occupation, basically that's the only sort of legally recognized occupation in the world besides Israel's occupation of Palestine, obviously. Then Emma Vigeland's in studio, and we're going to have to revisit the Yang Gang. We're going to have the definitive Marianne Williamson debate, talk about Iran, a whole bunch of other stuff. Michael Brooks Show tonight, live at 7, patreon.com/TMBS. And the host of This Is Hell, which is a legendary Chicago leftist radio show and now podcast, is going to be joining us at the Chicago Live Show August 24th at Lincoln Hall. So get your tickets. We'll see you there.
Oh, I've listened to his program many times.
I mean, he's a pretty impressive guy. He's been one of the original people in this whole space. So we're excited to have Chuck join us.
That's exciting. Matt, what's happening on Literary Hangover?
Yeah, we discussed the sort of meeting point between the Keynesian reformists and the Marxist revolutionaries by going through Rutger Bregman's Utopia for Realists. We talk about how he trashed Tucker Carlson and Davos and also Steven Pinker. So check that out, folks.
All right. See you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back. Back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 boy, back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back, 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 back.
Almost as what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back, back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ Danerke's song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Danerke.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break.
That's fucking nonsense.
Hey, folks, fucking reminder.
I do not have Parkinson's.
And the alpha males are...
Psych. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Almost says what?
What?
Almost says what?
Hell out of the bank. 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 Hell out of the bank.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black.
There doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle.
Come on. Fuck them. Fuck them. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday. My birthday.
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy.
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back. Back. Africans are black. Black. Alpha males are back. Back. Africans are black.
Pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy, 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 pussy.